Good morning, members. I'm going to go ahead and call the meeting of the Ed Finance Division to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Pryor, have you had an opportunity to review minutes?
I have, Chair Stancete, and I move that they be accepted.
Chair Pryor moves the minutes. Is there any discussion to the motion to approve the minutes from February 20th? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. We're going to do the minutes for the 22nd as well. Representative Pryor, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes from the 22nd?
I have, and I move their approval.
Representative Pryor moves the minutes from the 22nd. Is there any discussion regarding the motion to move the minutes for the 22nd? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Nay. Motion prevails. Up next, we have presentations from former Teachers of the Year and our current Teacher of the Year. So we will call up our testifiers. It looks like Kelly Holstein, Corey Bullman, Katie Smith, and Megan Olivia Hall, and Derek Olson. If you'd like, we can get two people, there you go, at the table, and the rest of us can be on deck. What a special day. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Kelly Holstein, and I'm an English teacher at Takata Learning Center in Shakopee, Minnesota. This is my 12th year of teaching and my 7th year at an area learning center. I'm the second alternative educator and the first out GLBTQ teacher to be named Minnesota State Teacher of the Year, and I do not take these roles lightly. Area learning centers have been given the unflattering nickname of A-hole's last chance. Try not to swear. It is true that our population can consist of students with varying abilities and temperaments, but these same students are also some of the most creative and brilliant humans with whom I have ever worked. And without fail, the students who arrive sad, hurt, angry, or scared reveal their authentic, vulnerable, brilliant, and beautiful selves when they feel safe and valued. My goal is to replace the negative narrative of Area Learning Center students with the truth. They are extraordinary human beings who are consistently underestimated and just need a safe place to become the best version of themselves. You have asked us to tell you about some barriers to student success. Some of our students struggle with chemical addictions, high ACEs scores, histories of abuse, PTSD, brains impacted by trauma, social anxiety, mental health challenges, homelessness, and learning disabilities. And our GLBTQ students, students of color, non-Christian students, and gender non-conforming students have faced extreme discrimination and prejudice in our schools. It is almost impossible to get into your learning brain when you don't feel safe, valued, or seen. I've had to learn a great deal in order to better serve my students. I learned how to stop being the sage on the stage, to change the overhead lighting, to add new seating options, to share control of the classroom with students, to create personalized, blended, voice and choice, self-paced curriculum that is dynamic and collaborative, to learn how to be a circle keeper and restorative justice practitioner, to make sure students see themselves in the culturally diverse and rigorous curriculum that they help create, and to fight for equity with everything I have. As an alt-ed teacher, I have increased my beliefs in compassionate accountability, curiosity over judgment, courageous connections, restorative practices, experiential education, dynamic containers, and the power of vulnerability. I discovered that the environment I create and the teaching model I employ have a significant impact on the curriculum that I teach. And I learned how to motivate students by not making them feel like perpetual failures. Because if they earn below a C in my classroom, they are assigned a not yet and are given more coaching until the assignments and their courses are mastered. A beautiful, powerful side effect occurred as a result of this process. The more I cared about the individual instructional needs of my students, the more I was able to show compassion and care for all of their individual needs. It was like a switch went off in my brain. I learned the difference between treating my classroom of students like a group with the same lessons and rules versus treating students as individuals while still being able to build a community of learners. And I continue to learn about the powerful and essential relationship between instructional practices, curriculum, environment, restorative practices, and equity. What an honor it has been to represent the 86,000 teachers in this state, and I have gained new insight on where our learning blocks are. As educators, I believe it is essential for us to own our own stuff in order to be better human beings and not let it come out sideways onto others, especially our students. The number one issue that I have observed and felt in our state is inequity. Equity is finding out what every student needs and getting it for them. It is an ongoing and dynamic process, and it benefits everyone. But not prioritizing equity is causing many of our Minnesota students to fail. As you probably know, the Minnesota has the worst opportunity gap of any state in the nation. According to a 2016 U.S. Department of Education report, Minnesota is ranked at or near the bottom of the nation for graduation rates for students of color. And these students are disciplined, suspended, and expelled at 3 times the rate of white students. All of this directly supports the school-to-prison pipeline. And as a previous case manager for youth without diplomas, I've seen firsthand how difficult it is for these young humans to find jobs and housing without that essential document. And while race is a component of equity, it's about anything that makes us unique humans. We need to do everything in our power to understand the impact of explicit and implicit bias, prejudice, and discrimination, and we need to own anything that we're doing that results in educational trauma for our students. And for equity to thrive, educators need to be trained in restorative practices and in creating culturally responsive classrooms. Waltz's One Minnesota budget and his support for the whole child could go a long way to decrease the opportunity gap. His desire to give more funding towards social-emotional supports and to recruiting and retaining racially diverse educators could be a game-changer for our students and for our schools. I will leave you today with a poem by Young Pueblo called You Are the Answer. They asked her, "What is the key to saving the world?" She answered, "You. You are the key. Heal yourself. Know yourself. Make yourself whole and free. Release all limits so that your love can flow unconditionally for yourself and the world. This will open the heaven of your heart completely, and it will guide you without fail. Please consider having empathy for yourself and others when things aren't perfect. None of our jobs are easy. And we all deserve to feel seen and heard. Plus, our students benefit when we all work together, not just on budgets and standards, but on how to become better human beings. And it is up to us to create environments that make it safe to be imperfect. Every kid matters, every heart matters, and we need each other to do this work. Thank you for having us here, and I hope we can continue to work together to make Minnesota a better place for every heart. Thank you for everything you do for our state, our educators, and our kids."
Thank you very much. I think what we're going to do is we're going to hear from all the testifiers, and then I will open it up to members if you have questions or comments that you want to share. Thank you for that. Up next, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Corey Bowman. I'm a proud public school teacher from the West Tonka Public Schools, ISD 277, and I was honored to serve as the 2017 Minnesota State Teacher of the Year. I appreciate you taking the time to listen to the Minnesota State Teachers of the Year talk about the issues concerning our schools right now. I'm a proud product of the public schools. I grew up attending a small public school system in Wisconsin, but moved here in 1994 to attend the University of Minnesota. I decided to teach, in part to honor all the hardworking, dedicated teachers that ready me for the world. Over the last year, I've had a number of unique opportunities. I've worked with amazing teachers from all over this country. I've met 2 U.S. Secretaries of Education, visited the Vice President's residency, and been hosted at the White House. I've also traveled this state meeting young people considering a career in teaching and worked with the state's most precious resource, our students. I'm an English teacher, so it's not surprising that I understand the world in stories. And I'd like to tell you a couple of stories this morning as a way to explain why I feel the issue of school funding is so important to our students right now. As you know, Governor Walz has proposed a $733 million increase for our K-12 system during the next 2 years. I don't pretend to know the ins and outs of complicated funding formulas or the math that would create the perfect dollar amount per pupil. I just know how the issues impact the four walls of my school. I know that last week I had to tell two thoughtful, insightful students that want to take our creative writing class next year that we have to wait to see if the class will run because we don't know if the numbers will hold up and if we'll have the funding to make the class go. I know that in November I had a young 16-year-old student in my room say to me, "I'm struggling right now, but I don't want to bother the guidance counselors with my problems," because she knew that our three committed guidance counselors each service almost 300 kids every day, and that she might not get a chance to talk to them as quickly as she would like or need. I tried to help her the best I could, but it's difficult that she knew she had to adjust her expectations for her care based on the fact that we don't have enough people to help her. I know the governor has proposed a $26 million investment in school safety. Again, this is just a number to me, but it wasn't a number to Ella, a student I had last year who, after a false alarm, forced us to sit huddled in the dark in my classroom for 45 minutes last May, said in the dark, "I'm afraid to come to school, and this is the one place where I shouldn't have to be afraid." This comment stayed with me, and it's the story I shared with U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos when I met her in the White House last year in May. It's the same sadness I now face as my own child, a first grader, came home to tell me about her first safety drill as an elementary student. I've always believed in the simple idea. Our society will be judged by how we care for our very young. It matters, and I want us to be on the right side of history. So, esteemed lawmakers, I ask you to see this debate not in terms of numbers, but in terms of stories. Make sure to visit our schools. Talk to our teachers and talk to our students. See the wonderful work being done by and for the young people in Minnesota. The investment is worth it. Again, I appreciate you taking the time to listen to us this morning, and I'd be more than happy to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Katie Smith and Megan Olivia Hall and Derek Olson.
This one's sitting real high.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, and how do you do? My name is Katie Smith. I am a licensed parent educator at Early Childhood Family Education, 29 years in Winona, 1 year in Robbinsdale, and this year at South Washington County Schools. You asked us to answer a couple of questions, and I'm really happy to do so. I have to tell you, all across the state of Minnesota, parent educators are doing this. Ready? HF1. Really excited about your bold vision for early childhood in this state. When you ask me to think about barriers to student success, I will tell you this, and I speak to you, Madam Chairman, the kindergarten teacher. When a barrier to the opportunity gap sometimes begins in kindergarten, as we have moved away from developmentally designed classrooms in favor of rigor-driven delivery, expecting five-year-old children to be just smaller versions of their fourth grade selves, denying them and denying us the magic of being 5 years old. Ignoring the fact that kids from 5 years old come to us from families with a variety of lived experiences, including preschool, a portfolio from preschool, childcare in home or in center-based or from grandma. They come from trauma and they come from joy. Sometimes we build a gap at the door. The solution is this. There are states based on the New American Ed study that are looking at how do states align birth to grade three well. The states that are doing it well have not moved rigor down into kindergarten and, dare I say, even into preschool classrooms, where sometimes in our state, four-year-olds are walking through hallways with sight words in their hands. But they recognize that play moving up is the way to bridge this gap. When we meet families and their precious new kindergartners at the door with play-based classrooms, we actually tell them, you're ready. You're curious, you're joyful, and you're ready, and we are ready for you. Let's meet them at the door with grace rather than an assessment that may tell them on that very first day that you're not at grade level. And when you're 5 years old, I have to tell you, I don't know what we mean by that. Five-year-olds are ready for anything. If you don't know one, find one, and they'll tell you. A barrier then, another one I thought of, was parents need access to ECFE for support, for education, and actually for the social capital it takes to navigate a school system. No one just walks in on a first day off a bus and figures out how it's done. There's lots of work that we do in early childhood that comes from learning how to navigate a school in a community of other brand new parents. My solution is to ask you to help us grow the parent education workforce, a workforce that exists only in Minnesota, that is the envy of other states all across the nation. Increase our capacity for home visits, for online courses, and other need-based outreach efforts. We do this work. We love this work, and we're licensed to do it. All over the state, in greater Minnesota, folks deal with these barriers by taking on mixed delivery, interesting community-based solutions that work well for the communities that we're serving. Another barrier is a child care shortage that actually makes me gasp sometimes. I love providers and travel the state and do all kinds of trainings for them, most notably this month in Thief River Falls. By the way, there is no falls in Thief River Falls. That's why I went the first time and I was disappointed. But there's really good folks there. And here's what I'll tell you. These are the folks who are at the heart of economic development in our state. A solution would be to lift the requirements for Parent Aware for licensed parent educators. Let them do the training work, the support work for providers right in their own neighborhoods so that they get quality training and quality support from a workforce that absolutely understands the work that they do. My Parent Aware number is 40792. The hoops that I had to jump through, were complicated to get licensed. I think we can make that easier for folks to do the work to support providers in their own home. We work alongside this population to support them and support parents with mentorship and training. And lastly, we compound any investment we make in early childhood by dedicating a portion of that investment for parent education. MNAFI, Minnesota Association of Family and Early Educators, is super excited about the work that you're laying down for this session. We are here to work alongside you, to help inform you, and to get this job done. I'll leave literature about our organization with the page to pass that out. Thank you so much for the work that you do. 4 and 5-year-olds do not have the opportunity to lobby, and I feel very honored to represent their voices and their parents' voices here today. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. Miss Olivia Hall.
My name is Megan Olivia Hall, and I am fortunate to teach science in St. Paul Public Schools. And I'm here to talk today about a different barrier, a barrier that we see at the high school level in our public schools, which is tracking, academic tracking. Since I was a high school student in our science department, it has been the norm across the state of Minnesota for ninth graders to either enter into a physical science course or, if they are deemed ready, an accelerated biology course. If students get into the accelerated biology course, they can meet another graduation requirement in 10th grade by taking chemistry or physics, and then are free during their 11th and 12th grade years to take AP, IB, college in the schools, or other college-level coursework. There's an enormous benefit to taking those college-level courses at the 11th and 12th grade level, and I have a list of research to support that I can leave here with a page as well. Some examples that we can see from just having access to AP courses include lower dropout rates, greater cognitive gains, higher teacher expectations, and as a result, better relationships with teachers. We see that when children have access to AP at the 11th and 12th grade levels, they are more likely to enroll in a selective college, they are more likely to graduate from high school, and they're more likely to succeed in college. In my school, we had a tracking system that we noticed was one of the permutations of institutionalized racism in our school. We saw that there were students of color that were being denied the accelerated pathway for capricious reasons. And for that reason, we decided to eliminate the lower track in our school's department. We did this in 2016. This year, in 2018, we had our first class of 11th graders who had experienced the DTRACT program start to have access in AP, and the number of AP science sections went from 1 to 4. We had an enormous increase in the number of students enrolled in our AP courses and also an enormous increase in the diversity of our AP course enrollment. The ways that we did this included changing the way that we taught that accelerated biology course. And so I would encourage anyone considering addressing the barrier of academic tracking to also provide not only diversity training to the teachers, but time to examine the ways in which their teaching continued to discriminate against students. Some ways that we changed our teaching were to increase our number of formative assessments, to have cooperative training exercises, to design tasks that honor the dignity of every student in collaborative group work, and then finally to, as Kelly spoke earlier, to really honor student choice in the assignments that we designed for our students. That's all I have to say, and I want to give the rest of the time to Dr. Olson.
Thank you. Mr. Hall, or I'm sorry, Mr. Olson.
Thank you. My name is Derek Olson. I live in Stillwater, Minnesota. As Mr. O, I've been teaching sixth grade in the state of Minnesota in St. Louis Park in Stillwater for the last 28 years. And as Dr. Olson, I occasionally teach graduate courses in education at University of Wisconsin River Falls and conduct research on teacher evaluation, teacher quality, and teacher retention. When I told my students that we were being asked to come and speak about a barrier to student success, they immediately begged me to talk about the barriers of snow and cold and what they thought you should do about that, which is specifically to give them a break on the days that they're supposed to make up. I told them that was not on the top of my list. But I did slide it in. The barrier I would like to talk about, however, is something I believe that is done by the best of intention, and that's testing, our state-mandated MCI tests, which I believe have become a barrier, and that we can get rid of that barrier. That current test measures growth. It comes in October, which is meaningless for the students that have taken it in the spring. And therefore, what happens is to get the data we do need as districts and schools across the state do other testing in addition to the state mandating testing, and it takes up a lot of time, and there's a significant impact. Some of those impacts include a loss of instructional time. I asked our testing coordinator in our building, 12 days of instructional time. Now, students aren't taking 12 days of tests. The average is about 5, but they lose 5, which is still significant. But for those 12 days of testing, no technology is available for anything else because it's all being pooled for testing. No para support is available for other things that are needed because those paras are giving small group mandated testing. The libraries are not open because the librarians and media specialists are being used to give small group testing. And our administrators are tied up. For 12 days, our instruction suffers because of testing. Of course, it's also expensive, and perhaps most importantly, it has a significant mental health cost on many of our students for whom it's a significant stress. But there are solutions. There are good tests out there. Our district used to use a great test called the NWA Map of Academic Progress. We gave it in the fall, we gave it in the spring, and we were able to measure growth and build a culture in our class and in our building and our school of not about did you pass, but are you growing, are you getting better. Unfortunately, it was too expensive for our particular district to keep up in a time of budget cuts. When we were using that, we were able to use that data to drive our instruction in positive, helpful ways that improved our students' learning experiences. So what I ask you to consider is to be brave enough to look at the fact that there's other options out there besides what we currently use, the MCA, the fact that so many districts are going in other directions as well, even though we know kids are over-tested, tells you that that test isn't giving us what we need. Consider a test that measures both growth and proficiency, and that by using that one test, simply given once in the fall, once in the spring, will alleviate so many of the issues with needing to do all this testing of our students. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Members, any questions? Okay, seeing none, before you step down, I just want to say a very heartfelt congratulations to all of you. To be an award recipient of Teacher of the Year is quite an accomplishment. This award for members, just if you don't know, these teachers are nominated for this award from their peers. It is really the cream of the crop rising to the top. And so congratulations for that, and thank you for the great work you're doing. Representative Joachim.
Thank you. And I'm, as the Ed Policy Chair, I'm hoping to delve into the testing next year. Would you suggest maybe before that shortening the MCAs with above and below grade level testing? I mean, what can we do that would help for this year? That would be a quicker, not fix, but maybe a Band-Aid approach. I know it's a loaded question. Sorry.
Mr. Hall. Feel free to jump in if you have an answer. Anybody. A Band-Aid approach is tough. I mean, if you wanted to, I guess, to not do them this year, that would work for me. again, as a teacher, having my students be stressed out about a test this spring, that the results they'll get at a fall conference next year when they're with different teachers, there's no positive impact for the students. But if we can take a test in the fall, take that same test in the spring, we already take a test. Every district buys a test that they give to their students in the fall to help figure things out in addition to everything. And so I guess more than anything, these kids in the system, they'll be there for a while. If you can come up with a great plan, even if it's not till next year, come up with a really, really good plan where kids can just have to take that one test twice a year. Teachers, good teachers can use that data. Schools can use that data. The state can still get what they need out of it, but eliminate the need to waste so many resources on so much over-testing.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And, yeah, it has to take, like you said, a longer discussion because tests are meant to measure different things.
Right.
And we do have requirements from the federal government to measure things. We want to make sure our standards are matching up with what we're teaching.
Absolutely.
So I appreciate your thoughts and wanted to let you know we're trying. We're looking
thank
at
you.
It. And I also wanted to thank the teacher, both the teacher here from the ALC. My husband's taught in those for years. I know how hard that work is. And also ECFE. ECFE saved my children from me. It was a phenomenal program, and everybody should go through it because everybody needs the tools to be a good parent. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Okay, any other questions? Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a point for the rest of the committee, we have two schools here that, with Shakopee and Stillwater, both their wrestling teams are in the state tournament starting this Thursday. And Shakopee is seated number one, and Stillwater is seated number two. Forest Lake is in there too. They're seated number five, so I had to mention that too. But good luck in the tournament. This is Class AAA, large schools.
Tournament time in Minnesota.
Any response? Thank you, Representative Detmer.
I had a student, it was 2 years ago, Alex Lloyd, who was, I think he got first, and he was at our school at Takata. Now, we don't always have a lot of folks at our school who also participate in the high school stuff, so it was a pretty exciting time for us to have one of our own do so well.
Absolutely. Follow up, any other questions? Representative Erickson.
Not a question, Madam Chair, but I think we should recognize our pages who are in the audience. They are actually our students, and they've been here listening to this presentation. So I think we should recognize them.
Excellent
Thank you.
Point. Welcome, and thank you for being here. Any other questions for our testifiers? Okay. Thank you so much, and again, congratulations. Up next, we have House File 247. This is an informational hearing establishing grant programs to increase student access to licensed library media specialists. Welcome to our committee, Representative Kunesh-Podein. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and begin with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I'm especially excited and happy to be here to present this bill to you today. In case some of you don't know, I am a library media specialist when I'm not here at the legislature. I was a classroom teacher for a bit, and then for the last 20 years or so have been a library media specialist in both the elementary level and currently at the middle school in Robbinsdale. The sad state of licensed library media specialists in our schools these days is that since 2007, between 2007 and 2017, Minnesota has lost approximately 25% of their school library media specialists. And library media specialists fill an especially important role as far as collaborating with the staff, with the students, and with our community. That means that today only 686 Minnesota schools have licensed library media specialists in them. So that means that 1,106 schools are going without a media center staff. It means that students are missing out on literacy and technology skills. It means that students are arriving to college without really valuable research skills. It means that our students are going without somebody there to help them find that just right book, not only to learn, but also to enjoy reading and become literate members of our society. It also means that there aren't those resources there to support our staff in the many different ways that we do, whether it's technology, to set up a staff development program, whether it's teaching kids how to access the internet safely, whether it's the ability to discern real news from fake news, to create bibliography, to share the resources that they have found in order to complete their different research programs. And then, of course, there's also the testing issue where oftentimes library media specialists such as myself have carried that responsibility to implement the library or the testing programs. So I would like to present to you today House File 247. And this bill creates a grant program to support the hiring of additional library media specialists. This grant will go to schools that do not presently have library media specialists in them, and it is a matching grant from the state for up to 6 years. School districts, charter schools, Bureau of Indian Education, tribal contract schools are all eligible to apply for this grant. And so the basic purpose of this grant is to ensure that our students are receiving effective support and to address the shortage of library media specialists in our Minnesota schools. It's a six-year matching grant, and we are especially looking to support our greater Minnesota schools that have additional struggles such as lack of broadband or internet or resources, being that they are so far out and far from the metro area. The last thing that this bill does, it does require a report, so we'd like to hear back from these schools once they receive the grants as to how much of a difference it made for them and for their students, and they would be able to submit a variety of different reports, including MCA test scores, their library circulation and usage, how much it has improved, what kind of technology skills the students have actually improved or been able to learn. Technology literacy, it's so important as we try to create our 21st century users for the future. We want to make sure that our students have effective research skills, that they are career and college ready, and we want to be able to see when schools are implementing a one-to-one program such as checking out a laptop or an iPad or some kind of technology that the student is able to take home and use to improve their learning skills and their technology skills. How much has that made a difference? This is an information-only testimony, but as this bill goes through the process, I hope that it will come back to this part to this committee, and at that time we will have some kind of an appropriation how much it will cost. But we would ask for your support at that time.
Representative Kunesh-Podin, I understand you have a testifier here with you today.
I do.
Ms. Mays, please come down.
I would like to introduce, come on over, Sally. Sally Mays is one of my partners in crime in the library media world. Ms. Mays has been the president of ITEM. She's also been my anchor the last two years as my sub when I came to the state legislature. And she is not doing it this year because she's actually really retired. and she wanted to be retired, but she's subbing for my sub today, and then decided to come here to share her experiences with you as well. So welcome.
Thank you. I'm really delighted to be talking.
Welcome to our committee. Go ahead and identify yourself and then proceed.
I'm kind of new to this. My name is Sally Mays. I am a retired teacher librarian, library media specialist, says that on my license. I have worked in a number of districts. As Mary said, I have been the past president of ITEM, which is the professional organization, the Information Technology Educators of Minnesota. I've also received the 2012 Technology Pathfinder Award from the American, the Association of American School Libraries. Wow, that's a mouthful. I'm here talking about one of my favorite subjects, but before I do that, I have a question for all of you. How many of you, and indicate by show of hands, had a school librarian growing up? And you are elected officials of the state of Minnesota. Need I say more? You're one of the fortunate ones. You can see, based on what Mary has said, that school librarians in schools are a disappearing breed, which is really, really shameful. I'm going to leave with you an infographic, and this pretty much sums up the reason why we should be supporting this bill. It has a picture of a school, plus a librarian and a student jumping for joy, and that is because their test scores have gone up. We have over 22 years of studies, empirical data that says when you have a school librarian in your school, your test scores go up. And school librarians, not in front of our principal, go, well, duh. And the reason that we say that is because we do so many things. Now, one of the things that we did do in the studies in Colorado, which this infographic is based on, they did factor out for demographics and income. Because one of the things when we talk about the importance of school libraries and student test scores going up, school people will say, well, yeah, those are rich districts and they can afford that. This factors this out. So regardless of the demographics, school librarians in a school with some money to buy books and technology help increase standardized test scores. And it doesn't make any difference whether or not you have a high population of free or reduced lunch. And in fact, for our students with free and reduced lunch, there have been a correlation study that says that these students often do not have reading materials in their home. Now, I'm not so foolish as to think that every student that comes to my school library and checks out a book is going to read it. But I do know if they go home and there's nothing to read, they're not going to read. So it's very important with all of our schools that we provide that. The other thing I wanted to talk about is the very cool aspect of an additional adult, a teacher, because all school librarians in the state of Minnesota have a teaching certificate, another adult in the building to help students. This is especially true in our middle school and high school, and we'll talk about elementary in a minute, but school libraries can often be a safe haven. It's the only place in many cases where someone will look at a student and say, how can I help you? What do you like to read? We do know that students achieve more when they have individualized learning. Well, there's nothing more individualized than getting a book that you want to read. And I always tell my students, now, don't worry. Try this book. Two chapters. If you don't like it, all of our books have a money-back guarantee. Bring it back, and we'll give you another one for free. they kind of get it when they're halfway down the hallway. But the other things that I will leave with you are a study that was done in Colorado. And why Colorado? This is where the big state library is. There is an entire page, which I will leave with all of the members so that you can go, and look at all the studies yourself. But it talks about the kinds of things that school librarians do. 70% taught students how to use digital resources. I'd love to tell you that our middle school students come to us with those skills. That's not always the case. 70% teach students how to use a variety of information gathering sources or information sources. 65% of school librarians help students use technology to organize and share. 59%, it's actually closer to 60, help students apply critical thinking skills. Now, when we talk about research, this is at all levels. Students as young as second grade can do research on animals. And then the critical thinking part is they had to tell us why this animal that they had researched would be a good pet. Now, the database that we are using did have dinosaurs, and many of the students chose Megalodon, which is the huge shark. Many of my boys thought that would be cool. And when asked to have the critical thinking skill, I said, well, would this be a good pet? And the little boy said, well, no, because you'd need a really big tank and it would have to be salt water and he might eat somebody. But if he would eat that big kid down the street, that might be okay. So there is some critical thinking skills going on here. Students, 52% of library media specialists help students evaluate the credibility of information sources. Can you think of a time in our history where that skill is not is as important as it is right now? Now, one of the other things that I often hear when we talk to school administrators say, well, you know, we'd really like to have a media specialist. I agree with you. They do wonderful things for our students, but we just can't afford it. Well, my contention is you can't not afford a media specialist, because in addition to being a teacher librarian and all the things that we do there, a reading advocate, a internet safety coach, assisting teachers and counselors find books for students in special situations, we're also a technology integrationist, where we will go to classroom teachers and offer our services and say, is there another way for us to help your students demonstrate what they've learned? A class that I worked with did research on the national parks, and we taught them how to make a web page. That's incredible to me. I can't imagine that. But fifth graders did this, and they did it really well, and they had to tell us why that national park is the one that they should go to. One of the other things that we were able to do when we're dedicated with our skills and experience, one of the standards in music and students have to perform. They have to do a performance. Many of them do them right in their classroom, but as you know, middle school is not the easiest time in life. And we had a student that just couldn't quite do that. So we used some technology. We offered her the opportunity to do her performance in front of a green screen, and then we did a taped version of that and played it to the class. Now, that may not be huge, but it was huge for that student, and it had ripples effects in the school. This student was not the strongest student. And when we talk about the counselor's office, this student was a frequent flyer. And after she had the opportunity to present in a way that was great for her, and her classmates came up and said, you did a great job. That was really amazing. The behavior changed. Now, is she absolutely a perfect student? No, but we do see a lessening of that. And if you don't have a media specialist in your school, that kind of interaction might not happen. The other thing that we do is professional development for both our staff and our students. Now, I hope I'm not carrying tales, but we often will help our administrators use their email effectively and use the technology that's available. Parent had to have an interaction with a principal. Wasn't an easy thing to do, and we were able to do that over FaceTime. And thank you. And the interaction was there. Now, is that an easy thing to do? Yes. But with a principal, if they have a partner in their building that they know they can rely on, that's something that can happen. I think that it's pretty much highlighting the things that I was going to say, but keep in mind that when you hire a library media specialist, you get a teacher librarian, you get a technology integrationist, you get a professional development, human resources for your staff, and a curriculum partner. That's four in one. What a deal. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Mays. Members, and to anybody in the audience listening, the reason that we're hearing these informational bills and other bills today is because today is the Library Association Day on the Hill, so welcome to that. Any questions from our members? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for you, Ms. Mays, from Mr. Heller in the audience.
Okay.
Who is our unofficial lobbyist for the print disabled. And so he's wondering to what extent a library addresses the print disabled. And he has handed me a schematic from the Department of Education that shows large print, braille, audio, digital text. So to what extent do libraries handle these issues for our non-readers or for those who need this help? Thank you.
Ms. Mays.
I'm sorry. I deeply appreciate the question. One of the things that we've seen explode are e-books and audiobooks, and we have those. Most schools have that in their collection that students can also access on snow days.
Yes.
And they just simply use their password and are able to get books online, and many of those books are audio. Now, in addition to that, we also have audio Spanish language and other language books. Spanish is the biggest one right now, but there is some French as well. So I hope that answers your question.
Well, it was for Mr. Heller, so thank you very much, Ms. May. I was just asking it on his behalf, but thank you, Madam Chair.
Any follow-up? Representative Sandel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question relating to the technology integration specialist as well as the librarian. The graphic that you handed out reinforces the experience that I had in the last two schools I taught at, when over a period of 10 years there were no individual classroom teachers added to the faculty, but a total of 10 people were added to assume responsibilities with the IT program. Mm-hmm. In one of those schools, the IT specialists were part of the library staff, and another they were pretty much separate of the staff. And as curriculum work and instruction in classrooms was growing with technology and dependent on technology, it seems to me that schools are forced with a lot of difficult decisions, putting money into technology, the hardware, as well as the staff, and providing the opportunities of the people, like you were talking about, the librarians, who have a variety of approaches toward teacher assistance and student assistance. And how do we go about balancing those? We do need to pay attention to technology support for all students, and we also really treasure the work that librarians provide our classrooms. How do we balance that?
Ms. Mays, or to the author?
Well, first off, thank you very much. I love to hear the words, we treasure librarians. I think that one of the things that you will find is that if you spend money in a district on hardware and don't provide the support staff, you're out of luck. So I think every district needs to look at a balance. But maybe my opinion, little less hardware and a little bit more funding for the people to help make it work. I hope that's a good answer.
Follow up?
No, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate the work and the service and bringing the issue to our attention. It's really important.
Thank you.
Representative Jergens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kunesh-Podein, on the second page, the bill outlines matching grants, dollar for dollar, three for one, one for three, and so forth. But there's no grant amount, total grant amount in the bill. Do you have a ballpark figure in mind?
Representative Kunesh-Podein.
You know, I'm sorry, at this time I don't have a full fiscal note. There are a lot of variables there. If you look at that matching grant amount, it breaks it down into a metro match and a non-metro match. Non-metro matches are, should we say, a little more generous in order to encourage greater Minnesota to take advantage of this match. And so there just are so many variables at this time that we haven't quite worked that out. Okay. But thank you for pointing that out.
Follow-up question?
And then just what happens then to these positions after the 6 years, after the grant period is over? Then is it just comes from the school's budget, the general fund, or are there other plans in place?
Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. We hope that the outcome will be that the school districts rediscover the value of a licensed media specialist and realize that the investment for those 6 years is a lifelong investment for the students and for the school district. So we would hope that they would continue that. And then if we find that it is such a successful grant, perhaps we would find a way to broaden those grants or broaden the opportunities to reintroduce the value in the library media specialists into our school districts across the state.
Follow up. Any other member questions? Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Representative Kunesh-Podein, when you have a licensed school media specialist, is the library open to the students on a longer time than the school schedule?
Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Murphy. You know, that is an individual school decision, what the hours of the libraries will be. I know in my schools that I've been at, oftentimes kids will be dropped off early before school actually starts, and we have welcomed them into our library to sit quietly and study or read. Sometimes kids fall back to sleep for a while. We oftentimes will have after-school programs. The computer labs will be open for additional tutoring or technology skills. And it's not just for the students, but we often, as library media specialists, will offer technology classes for our staff, so professional development. We will encourage meetings to happen in our libraries for the entire district. Oftentimes, we're able to write grants, and library media specialists write a lot of grants. Three years ago, I wrote two grants and was able to secure close to $15,000 for my library for new books and new furnishing. So the library is really the hub of the school, and it's available from the minute I walk into the building to the minute I leave, and sometimes after that. There are a lot of kids that are very overwhelmed at lunchtime, the noise, the commotion. We have made that available as another quiet, safe place. Students that are feeling bullied or marginalized oftentimes will come to our library and see it as a safe place. So it is a hub, and we welcome all the students and the staff to take advantage of our skills as well as the opportunities and the technology that we have available to them. Thank you.
Representative Murphy, follow up?
No.
Okay. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifiers and the representative, I'm kind of curious. In my time frame, I've seen the Dewey Decimal System and paid library fines. But the question I have is, like any industry or any profession, where do you see us in 20 years? Where do you see library science going in 20 years? And do you see anything now that's out there that is intriguing you? And what can we see?
Ms. Mays, or to the author?
Do you just want to
Carter.
Representative Kunesh-Podein. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I know at one point, especially when technology came into to play, people were saying that books and libraries are obsolete, but I think we're finding that that's quite the opposite. We have a lot of students that enjoy coming in, looking through our stacks, looking through our books, finding one that has a picture of somebody that looks just like them or has a life experience that's very similar to theirs, nonfiction that expands their personal interests. So I see our libraries expanding as is what I hope. Our public libraries are also not going away, and we are just a natural extension of those public libraries. We have the skills and the opportunity, the resources available, and you know, I personally love to learn new technology. I love to share that with my students. I love to be able to have them share it back to me. I probably have learned 70% of my technology skills from my students, so it's a pretty mutual process here. So I'm optimistic that libraries are here to stay.
Follow-up?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, at this time, the committee would like to hear from anyone from the public who would like to testify. Mr. Heller? Go ahead and approach the microphone. Please state your name for the committee, and we'll keep this to about a minute or two. Go ahead and proceed.
Hello, everybody. My name is Rick Keller, unofficially represented twice exceptional people with print disabilities. I come to testify today on February 26th in the Education Finance Division Committee. I was, confirm me if I'm correct or not, but in 1931 it was the librarians that codified print disability. People that were visually sighted were accessing the same tapes as the blind, and they didn't know what, frankly, to do other than let's give them access to those materials.
I'm not 100%.
But that was a survey. You're the 35th person I surveyed as a librarian.
Oh, okay.
And majority didn't quite know the answer. Because it's my understanding St. Catharines is the one that does the librarians in our state.
They are one of the programs, yes.
And I talked to the librarian upstairs, the legislature librarian, and they did not mention the fact that there was librarians that came up with the word print disability, and she never heard it in her training. The thing of this is that reading is not natural. You have to first learn to read, then read to learn. It's, if you don't get rewired to read well by third grade, Act of Congress required all the books to become digitized in 2007 for a reason, specifically in the National Instructional Accessibility Standards. All core books are required to be in that format, approved at the American Printing House of the Blind. So once that became that way, it's my understanding that media specialists specifically have to modify that based on the student's instructional reading level based on the core material. Is that correct?
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Heller.
Well, this...
The question...
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'll answer that question.
Representative.
Yes, we modify access to reading material all of the time. We assess the student, their reading levels, their reading interests, and, you know, individualize those choices. Now, if we have a student that has a reading disability of sorts and would need the audiobooks or larger print books or technology assistance with the books, you know, those are the sort of things that we work very hard to make sure that they have an equal access to the same information that all the other students are getting.
Yeah, through the chair again, it's my understanding that a medical doctor is the only one that can prescribe a print disability. Reading disability is not in the statute. It's my understanding that school districts have to determine at what severity triggers the reading disability other than two standard deviations. However, it's a the school district's my understanding, but the medical doctor orders a print disability and considers to consult with their colleagues. It's a requirement that they get it in a through the National Accessibility Standards and the center. So again, it's my understanding that this whole piece of this is, are librarians required currently to go into the materials at the American Printing House of the Blind, the center, and modify those source code books in a way? And then secondly, since Lexiles is now our national standard, it's also embedded in the NWA assessment and the MCAs, which is basically, it's my understanding, that's the guide for librarians to give a range, a specific range for each individual child as it relates to access in the printed word. Is that correct?
I'm going to make a comment first, and then I'm going to let you respond, Representative Kunesh-Podein. Mr. Heller, in terms of your comment about a physician making a diagnosis, educators have to make interventions all the time that are appropriate for their students. And I think what you heard from Representative Kunesh-Podein before is that they do that whether there's a diagnosis or not. If the professional is recognizing that there is a need for a student, educators are doing everything they can within their means to provide them with whatever accommodation they need or whatever is available. So I don't know if that helps, Representative Kunesh-Podein. I'm going to let you respond, and then we need to wrap this portion up to move on to our next bill. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to reply to you, as Madam Chair said, we do our best to accommodate that student and provide the materials. And oftentimes we go outside of the realm of what our responsibility might be. But if there's a student with a physical issue that affects their reading, of course, that's probably going to go into something like an IEP. There is technology assistance that school districts might provide. I've helped a number of students with accessing their technology to do those sort of things. So our role here is to ensure that all of our students are receiving the books, the resources that are going to help them become that better reader, that better student, that better citizen.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Thank you for your testimony.
I agree.
Mr. Heller, thank you for your testimony. We do need to move on right now to other members from the audience that may have questions. Okay. At this point, we're going to move on to our next House file. Any closing comments, Representative Kunesh-Podein? I apologize.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to just thank Ms. Mays here for coming in today and sharing her wealth of information and experience. And when this comes before you as a party, as a bill down the road, I'd hope that you would fully encourage it passing. Thank you.
Thank you. Up next, Representative Murphy, House File 1282. This is a bill regarding regional public library systems, aid distribution, and modifications to that. Good morning, Representative Murphy. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I move that the House File 1282 be held over for consideration in the Education Finance Omnibus Bill.
Very good. Proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you know that I have a thing about libraries, and people of Minnesota join me in having a thing about libraries and the access to libraries. And we've gone to libraries since some kind of a library, lending library, since Minnesota was a territory. And the people of Minnesota are sometimes they're passionate about their libraries, and other times they barely know where they are. But when they have a reason to go to the library for some purpose, they always find it. And there are people there, just as in the schools, that are trained to help them, whether they need a tax problem solved
a computer problem solved or whether they just need something for a rainy day at the cabin. You just have to have some kind of ability to know that every Minnesotan can be served by the libraries. And the method that the libraries have developed across the state is to form regional libraries and partnerships with counties and cities and the state for funding of the libraries. And the state funds the regional library systems as well as the school systems libraries through the Education Department. Minnesota Department of Education is solely responsible for the basic funding formula that is complicated and beyond my ability to explain in detail, but we have a grid in your packet, and we have house research explanation of the packet. And we don't do a lot as an education finance committee of maintaining library system raises. And members, it's time. We have not funded an increase to the library system since I've been on education finance. And this is my third term on education finance. And Margaret Kelleher was speaker the last time we funded an increase. I believe that's right. An increase to the basic formula that reaches out to all Minnesotans for their media and computer and reading needs. And so it's time, members. And this bill would fund that. Now, there are people here that are librarians. It's a Minnesota Library Day at the Capitol. And Ann Hokanson, the executive director of the Travis DeSoud Library Cooperative, is here. And Liz Lynch from Lake Agassiz Regional Library Director is here. And Hung Russell, on behalf of the Friends of the Hennepin County Library, are here. And they're going to tell you about what a raise would mean to them or what they do with the state funding for the library system.
Very good. Ms. Hokanson, Ms. Lynch, and Mr. Russell, come on down and introduce yourself for the record and go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Ann Hokanson, and I'm the director of the Travis DeSoud Library Cooperative. I'm also serving this year as the Minnesota Library Association Legislative Chair, which is a position that the association has regularly because getting adequate state funding for libraries is so difficult and so important. So we've been working at this for quite some time. I have with me here in the audience many library supporters who are here to show their support, and many of you have appointments later today with them to help explain some of our issues. I want to thank Representative Murphy for her long-standing support of libraries. And Representative Murphy, I'm sorry that it's been taking us so long, and I hope this is the magic year. So in front of you, you do have the overview of the bill and the complicated chart there. My role today is to talk about how the regional aid affects the state and what some of the problems are and the proposed solutions. Then my colleague Liz Lynch will talk about how it directly affects Lake Agassiz Regional Library. But I would like to point out to you that many systems experience similar things. With that, I'm going to just launch into my written remarks so that I don't get too off track, because I very easily can talk about libraries 24/7. So excuse me while I read to you. My library system, Traverse de Sioux Regional Library System, is headquartered in Mankato. We serve 9 surrounding counties. Regional library systems are distributed across the state. I'm here today to testify on the behalf of everyone, because regional library systems have collaborated to work together to bring forward this legislation. Minnesota's public libraries are in every county and serve all Minnesotans. Minnesotans use their libraries at high rates compared to the rest of the nation. Minnesota's libraries are powerful education engines because they collaborate and share. We are all very used to the idea that we can get a free public library card and have access to literally millions of books on any subject, even if we are using a library that would fit inside this room. Many of the libraries in my region would literally fit inside this room. That's why I'm here today. We're so used to that idea that we can forget it takes deliberate effort, designed systems, and funding to make it true. Our state's regional public library systems connect our libraries together, making it possible for Minnesota children and adults to explore ideas and learn regardless of where they live, regardless of the size of their local library. Public libraries in Minnesota are primarily funded with local dollars from city and county government. Regional Library Basic System Support, or RLBSS, the funding I am asking for you today, my phone just moved, only covers about 7% of the total cost of operating libraries. So while the total amount of money seems like just a huge amount of money to me compared to my household budget, it's just 7% of what we spend on public libraries in our state. But this state public library funding is what is the funding that ties all of our libraries together, because just as the name of the funding suggests, it provides the basic system support to our regional systems. The boards that govern each of the regional public library systems have all endorsed the funding levels and formula distribution included in House File 1282. The existing formula and funding levels are putting some of our regional library systems in real jeopardy and making it very difficult for all of the systems to plan and deliver services responsibly. I want you to take a look at your chart and notice that this is a description of what would happen going forward. What you don't have in front of you is the historic information, which shows the dramatic changes in funding that each of the systems have experienced over the past number of years. And Liz Lynch will talk to you more about that. The boards of each of the systems recognize that for Minnesota to achieve the goal of statewide access to quality library service, we need this bill. Liz, from Lake Agassiz Regional Library System in back of me, is going to tell you about her specific experience. Her system's circumstances are not unique. Many of our state systems, including the one I work for, are in similar dire straits. I want to emphasize that there is unanimous regional public library system support across the state for this bill because it is needed to stabilize funding for each system. Every library system relies in part on the others, and we are all much stronger together. Local library boards and city and county governments have also widely endorsed this funding request. In my region, 8 county boards and many cities have passed resolutions supporting the funding request and formula change. Individual library boards have done so as well. There is widespread support for this bill because it fixes a real problem that ultimately affects every public library in the state. It isn't enough to love libraries. Public libraries are one of our nation's most loved institutions, but it takes money to run them. Please support this bill.
Thank you very much. Ms. Lynch. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Liz Lynch, and I am here representing Lake Agassiz Regional Library System, and I'd just like to thank you for this opportunity today. I'm the director of the Lake Agassiz Regional Library System, which is located in northwest Minnesota and headquartered out of Moorhead. Lake Agassiz Regional Library provides public library service in 22 communities in a 7-county service area. The counties that we serve include Polk, Clearwater, Norman, Mahnomen, Clay, Becker, and Wilkin counties. Regional Library Basic System Support, or RLBSS, is very important to Lake Agassiz Regional Library and other rural Minnesota library systems as well, where other non-government funding sources are scarce. RLBSS is the funding that can help our public libraries reach their full potential and make the most impact in our communities. Because of the extreme weight of equalization in the formula factors used to allocate state dollars to regional library systems, starting in 2009, Lake Agassiz Regional Library started seeing huge decreases in RLBSS funding. In the first year, 2009, we lost about $96,000, which was a significant loss for us. Unfortunately, we continued to see decreases in funding year after year. An effort to avoid deficit spending, as employees retired or left their positions, we chose not to fill them. We looked for every efficiency we could find. We asked current employees to do more with less without being able to guarantee a living wage. We eventually had to move towards eliminating personnel and reducing hours. We are now down to bare-bones staffing. Having the minimum amount of staff, compounded by years of decreased funding from the state, has had a huge impact on our regional library system. We're moving right along, offering the best services we possibly can, and I do believe we are making a difference in our communities. But it almost hurts to think of how much more of an impact we could still be making on our communities and how many more people we could reach if the resources were still available to us today. Regarding our communities, poverty and transportation are two huge issues. We would love to dream big and experiment with new services and outreach, but with limited staff and limited resources, this is not always a reality. We would love for our employees to be more involved in statewide initiatives, but the fact is we're geographically and financially challenged. We are always seeking alternative funding options from donors or granting institutions, but when you don't have the staff to write the grants or jump through the hoops that are often required, follow-through can be close to impossible. Lake Agassiz Regional Library is primarily funded by 5 cities and 7 counties, which we refer to as our signatories. Our signatories are currently providing over 75% of our operating budget. The Laurel signatories have been very generous over the years, but they've made it very clear that they are beginning to max out. I dread the day when I go and ask for an increase for our regional library system from our signatories and they say no, because that reduction, that if they say no, we are going to see reductions in hours or even closures in communities where library services are their only source of information, entertainment, access to computers and the internet, and their only free place in town where they can feel that real sense of community. For Lake Agassiz Regional Library and library systems across the state, an increase in RLBSS funding and a formula change would mean funding stability from 1 year to the next. More library books and materials to fill community demand. More employee hours to offer one-on-one assistance to library patrons and to help those who need it most. Innovative services and delivery methods for better meeting the needs of our communities. And more opportunities for collaboration and partnership so we can reach our full potential and help our community members reach their full potential as well. Our current formula does not serve Minnesotans well. Without a formula change and an increase in funding, we are simply kicking the can down the road. A $4 million increase, along with a formula change, would mean stability for public libraries and improved services across the state for all Minnesotans for years to come. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lynch. Mr. Russell, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Hung Russell, and I'm a resident in the Marcy Homes neighborhood in Minneapolis. Thank you, Representative Murphy, for introducing this bill. I wish to thank the committee for this opportunity to speak as a patron of the Hennepin County Library. I currently serve as co-president of the Friends of the Southeast Library and co-president of the President's Council of the Friends of the Hennepin County Library. The Friends of the Hennepin County Library fundraises, creates awareness, and supports programming and the material collections at the 41 branches of the Hennepin County Library system. This umbrella organization is comprised of 38 currently active local friends groups, volunteers who meet and work to support their respective libraries. Libraries have been an integral part of my life, offering me a window into a larger world of imagination and knowledge. As a result, I became the first member of my family to graduate from college, the first to obtain a master's degree, and the first to become a licensed architect. Several years ago, when I became semi-retired, I felt a need to engage in volunteer work and give back to the community. Our local Southeast Library Friends group was being formed at that time, and through my association with the group, I came to have a deeper appreciation of the role of our libraries. Local libraries are a nexus of community involvement and interaction. While we have discussions today about the relevancy of a physical library in this digital age, I contend that libraries, more than ever, have an important role to play. A few years ago, I had the opportunity to participate on an advisory committee to envision a future Southeast Library. This vision would guide the programming for a planned renovation project for the library, which is currently underway. One of the key takeaways that came up in our discussions was the nearly universal desire for communal elements, meeting spaces, mentoring spaces, maker spaces. People wanted places that allow them to share their knowledge and cultural experiences. And that theme is reflected in part by the current emphasis of the Friends of the Hennepin County Library. That the Friends groups be ambassadors to the communities and help identify programming by which their local library can best serve them. In summation, local libraries are no longer static repositories of books, but are required to be ever-evolving and adapting to meet the needs of their communities. And there is a yearning for places and resources that allow people to participate in the learning process as a community. It has always been my belief that libraries are the final bastions of an unfettered democracy, welcome to all, and providing free access to information. As we invest in our libraries, we invest in their capacity to nurture the souls of our communities. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Russell. Any questions from members? Representative Juergens.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Murphy, taking aside the $4 million increase, just looking at the changes in the calculations, which is taking the base aid distribution from 5% to 15%, so increasing that by 10%, and then reducing the adjusted net capacity per capita distribution from 25 to 15. What were you trying to accomplish with this shift?
Representative Murphy.
The changing demographics of the various areas and the kinds of services that the regional library system is trying to deliver.
Follow up? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think it's not easy to make any change at all in the formula of the regional library systems. And they have come to an agreement that this formula would serve the most people in the best way in Minnesota. And the big system, the little systems, are all working together and support this change.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Murphy, prior to coming to the legislature, I was on the Washington County Library Board, so this is something that is, I do see the value in it. And I was going through the numbers trying to see if there are winners and losers, and it's pretty spread out. I mean, there aren't any big, significant changes. And with the $4 million increase, everybody sees an increase to some extent. The percentages seem to be relatively minor, with MELSA taking the biggest decrease percentage-wise. So I just wanted some clarification on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for pointing that out.
Any other member questions? Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't really have a question, but during the Pawlenty administration, when Alice Segrin was commissioner, she and I toyed with the idea of moving libraries into a small agency concept. And we worked at that, didn't accomplish it, because we both agreed that having it in the K-12 funding was always an issue. And Representative Murphy knows about, you know, how this always happens to libraries, that they're the last, one of the last on the spreadsheet. You know, maybe we need to think in the future, if we would expand the importance of a library, how we move it out of K-12 and into a small agency. After all, we fund Purpich as a small agency to the tune of $8 million, and we're only serving a little over 100 students. Here we're serving thousands of residents. So, you know, something to ponder.
Millions.
Representative Murphy.
Millions. I totally agree, but before what Representative Erickson was talking about, I had the idea that we needed a legislative audit report, and we got that. And I thought that that, on the same length, that that might tell us to do something differently. But these regional library systems are strong, and the people in them are true, true believers. And they don't want the legislature messing around with a structure that reaches all of Minnesotans. And so we don't go very far very quickly. But one of the responsibilities we as a legislature has is doing funding that will stabilize and continue the services that they provide with their mighty strength and power that they have in their local areas. And the regional library system, I believe that it is here, and we have to fund it, and we can keep taking these little steps or thinking of how else it works. But you know what? The regional library boards that always come to a solution to a problem, and this is it for the next few years if we fund it. And we should be funding it at least this with this strength, if not more.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Are there any members from the audience or from the public that would like to testify? Mr. Heller, you may come down and testify, but we are bumping up against the time limit, so please keep your comments or your questions to a minute.
Make it a comment.
Rick Heller, unofficial representative, twice exceptional and print disabled, a testifying in education finance on the 26th of February. I never knew the legislature actually specifically funded libraries. I just found that out. You micromanage them just like you do the two academies, the blind and deaf. I support a raise, obviously. I don't know if this is considered cost of living, but unless you actually put that in the bill, I think that would be relevant, what the teachers get when you do that, too. So thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. And with that, any closing remarks, Representative Murphy?
I renew my motion.
With that, Representative Murphy renews her motion to lay House File 1282 over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. With that, the division hearing is adjourned.